The young man in front of me was a far more human incarnation than court transcripts or psychiatric reports could ever conjure. More human, perhaps, than I wanted him to be. The power he discharged in one terrible second on the steps of Rebecca Schaefer's apartment wasn't in that cell with us. He didn't have the confidence to intimidate anyone, nor did he have those dead, cold, murderer's eyes that intimidate all on their own. In fact, he was reluctant to even look at me. We both knew what a murderous thing he'd done, and he knew very well from the trial exactly how I felt about it. Bardo had been asked a great many questions since the killing, and he was used to that, so I decided to let him speak first, to follow rather than lead him. As it turned out, that took a lot of patience. For about 15 minutes we just sat there, him with his head down, me counting on the idea that he wouldn't be able to pass up the attention I was withholding. The otherwise quiet cell was occasionally filled with the clang of some distant gate being slammed. Noise is one of the few things that roams freely in a prison. The concrete walls that keep out so much carry it into every corner. Bardo finally looked up at me and studied my face intently. "Arthur Jackson asked me to give you a message." Jackson was the obsessed stalker who had brutally stabbed actress Teresa Saldana. After I testified against Jackson in court, he condemned me to burn in hell.
"He wants you to meet with him, too."
"Not today," I replied.
"Then why do you want to talk to me?"
"Because you have something to contribute," I answered.
"I'd want to help other people avoid what happened to Rebecca," he said.
That choice of words implied some distance from his crime, which I didn't want to grant him. "Nothing just happened to Rebecca. You make it seem as if she had an accident."
"No, no, I killed her, I shot her, and I want to help others not get killed by someone like me."
"That sounds like you think there's someone else like you."
He seemed surprised that it wasn't obvious. "There is. I mean, there are many people like me."
He was quiet for a long while before he continued.
"I'm not a monster. On television, they always want to portray me as someone frightening."
I looked at him and nodded. We'd been together for nearly a half hour, and I hadn't asked him a single question.
"I was someone frightening, of course, but I'm not now. That video of me telling how I shot Rebecca makes me look like the worst assassin of all, and I'm not the worst."
He was concerned about his public image, about how he stacked up against his peers. Like nearly all modern-day assassins, Bardo had studied those who came before him. After Mark Chapman went to prison for killing John Lennon, Bardo wrote to him and asked why he had done it. Chapman, the famous assassin, and Bardo, the apprentice, had a brief correspondence.
"If he had told me not to do my crime," Bardo said, "that would not have overridden my emotions. Emotions are the key. Out-of-balance emotions. Emotionally healthy people do not harm others."
Bardo had also studied everything he could find on the Arthur Jackson case. Jackson had hired a private detective to locate his victim. So Bardo did too. Jackson used a knife, so on one of his earlier trips to kill Schaefer, Bardo brought one along. Jackson traveled thousands of miles in pursuit of his target, sometimes in a crisscross fashion, as do nearly all assassins, and Bardo did too. They started off a continent apart, but ended up living in the same building. In a videotaped interview done by the defense months before Bardo knew I was working on the case, he revealed the extent of his research into public figure attack. Describing the lack of security he had encountered around Rebecca Schaefer, he said, "It's not like she had Gavin De Becker or anything." Now, in offering me advice, Bardo hoped to distinguish himself from other assassins. He would become, he thought, the anti-assassin, helping famous people avoid danger. Of course, he was now famous himself, a fact that carried him to an almost too ironic comment on public life. "All the fame that I have achieved from this results in me getting death threats and harassment. The media says things about me that aren't even true. I have no control over them invading my privacy, bringing up my case over and over again on TV so they can make money off it.
They portray me in ways I never saw myself. He didn't like reporters calling him a loner, but the description was accurate. Bardo had no friends and had never even kissed a girl romantically. Almost certainly, he never will. A lack of healthy intimacy is a common feature of many assassins. John Hinckley didn't ever attain a developed romantic relationship, nor did Arthur Jackson, nor did Arthur Bremer, who shot presidential candidate George Wallace. Bremer was a virgin, who sought to change that in the weeks before his crime. Knowing he would soon be dead or imprisoned for life, he hired a prostitute, but their sexual encounter ended awkwardly. In his diary he wrote, "Though I'm still a virgin, I'm thankful to Alga for giving me a peek at what it's like." Bizarre though it may seem, the greatest intimacy most assassins attain is with those they attack. Through stalking, they come to know their victims more closely than they know others in their lives, and through shooting them, they become partners of sorts. Bremer's diary shows increasing intimacy with his first victim of choice, President Richard Nixon. As he stalked the president from state to state, the diary references move from the president to he to Nixon to Nixie, and ultimately to Nixie Boy. Those who attack with knives have even more intimacy. As is disturbingly described in multiple murderer Jack Henry Abbott's book, In the Belly of the Beast. Of one of his murder victims he wrote, "You can feel his life trembling through the knife in your hand. It almost overcomes you, the gentleness of the feeling at the center of a coarse act of murder." Bardo's coarse act of murder was, with the saddest irony, inflicted on the only girl who ever gave him any positive attention. Rebecca Schaefer had sent a kind reply to one of his letters. Bardo. It was a personal postcard where she wrote, "Robert, Dash, your letter was the nicest, most real letter I ever received." She underlined real. She wrote, "Please take care," and drew a heart sign and then Rebecca. That's what propelled me to want to get some more answers from her. So what advice would you offer other famous people? Be careful about what you write. If you do answer fan mail, don't let it be so overglowing. That's not the way to be with a fan, because it makes it seem like they're the only one, and that's how I felt. I felt I was the only one. Like other assassins, Bardo had stalked several famous people, including a client of mine whom he decided was too inaccessible. He gave up on her and switched his attention to Rebecca Schaefer. For assassins, it's the act and not the target, the destination, not the journey that matters. Because targets are interchangeable, I asked Bardo how the security precautions taken by some public figures affected his choice. He said, "If I read in an article that they have security and they have bodyguards, it makes you look at that celebrity different and makes a person like me stand back. It kind of stands against this hope of a romantic relationship." Though Bardo's defense tried to sell the idea that he expected a romantic relationship with Rebecca Schaefer, he never really did. Bardo expected exactly what he got, an unenthusiastic reception and ultimately a rejection. He used that rejection as an excuse to do what he had long wanted to do, release his terrible anger against women, against his family, and against the rest of us. Of course, to care about being rejected by a total stranger, one must first come to care about that stranger. Bardo did this by obsessing on each of his various targets. Even today in prison, he's still doing it, focusing intently on two women. One is a singer, and the other is someone who was not famous when he first heard of her, but is very famous now, Marcia Clark, the prosecutor who sent him to prison for life. In a letter Bardo wrote to me, he explained, "Twice, the Daily Journal has profiled Marcia Clark. I learned a lot. Turn to page 2 to give you an idea." Page 2 was a lengthy list of personal facts about Marcia Clark and her family. It's a convoluted irony of the media age that Marcia Clark prosecuted a regular citizen who stalked and killed a famous person, then prosecuted a famous person, O.J. Simpson, who stalked and killed a regular citizen, then became famous herself, and is now the focus of a stalker. Media age assassins are not unlike another uniquely American icon, the daredevil. If you understand Evel Knievel, you can understand Robert Bardo. Like those of a daredevil, all of an assassin's worth and accomplishment derive from one act, one moment. This is also true for most heroes, but assassins and daredevils are not people who rise courageously to meet some emergency. The assassin and the daredevil create their own emergencies. The daredevil fantasizes about the glory of accomplishing his stunt, the fame that waits for him on the other side of the canyon. The media have portrayed the daredevil as a courageous hero. But what if someone got the motorcycle, painted it special, got the colorful leather pants and jacket, got the ramps, notified the press, got all set up at the canyon, and then didn't do it? Suddenly, he's not cool and special. He's pathetic. Now he's a guy whose silly name and goofy accessories add up to geek, not hero. The whole thing loses its luster if he doesn't do it. Arthur Bremer wrote, "I want a big shot and not a little fat noise. I am tired of writing about it, about what I was going to do, about what I failed to do, about what I failed to do again and again. It bothers me that there are about 30 guys in prison now who threatened the prez, and we never heard a thing about them." Assassins, you see, don't fear they're going to jail. They fear they are going to fail, and Bardo was no different. He had gotten all the components together. He had studied other assassins, he had researched his target, made his plan, gotten the gun, written the letters to be found after the attack. But like the daredevil, he was just a guy who worked at Jack in the Box until he made that jump, until the wheels left the ground, until he killed someone famous. Everything that goes with fame was waiting for him on the other side of the canyon where, in his words, he'd finally be a peer with celebrities. When he found Rebecca Schaefer and was face to face with her, he had all the credentials of an assassin, but he couldn't pick up his prize until he shot her. Since he was 14 years old, he had known what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he got there on the steps of Rebecca Schaefer's apartment building. Robert Bardo was a career assassin, a killer for whom the victim was secondary to the act. Some people put years into their heroic accomplishments. Assassins do not. While stalking Richard Nixon, Bremer wrote, "I'm as important as the start of World War I. I just need the little opening and a second of time." Such narcissism is a central feature of every assassin. And like many of their characteristics, it's in us all to some degree. In his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Denial of Death, Ernest Becker observes that narcissism is universal. Becker says every child's whole organism shouts the claim of his natural narcissism. It is too all-absorbing and relentless to be an aberration. It expresses the heart of the creature, the desire to stand out, to be the one in creation. Becker says we all look for heroics in our lives, adding that in some people, it is a screaming for glory, as uncritical and reflexive as the howling of a dog. But the howls for glory of assassins had been unanswered in their mundane pre-attack lives. The assassin might be weird or unusual, but we can't say we don't understand his motives, his goal. He wants what Americans want, recognition, and he wants what all people want, significance. People who don't get that feeling in childhood seek ways to get it in adulthood. It's as if they've been malnourished for a lifetime and seek to fix it with one huge meal. The same search for significance is part of the motivation for the young gang member who kills because violence is the fastest way to get identity. Murderer Jack Henry Abbott describes the involuntary pride and exhilaration all convicts feel when they are chained up hand and foot like dangerous animals. The world has focused on us for a moment. We are somebody capable of threatening the world. Ernest Becker writes, The urge to heroism is natural, and to admit it, honest. For everyone to admit it would probably release such pent-up force as to be devastating to society. Well, Bremer, Hinckley, and Bardo all admitted it, with devastating results. Each first aspired to make it in Hollywood, but gave that up for a faster, easier route to identity. They knew that with a single act of fraudulent heroism, with one single shot, they could be forever linked to their famous targets. Like all endeavors, assassination is reached by a certain protocol, certain hoops one jumps through. Many of these are detectable, observable hoops that leave a trail we can follow. Assassins teach each other, each learning something from the ones before. When I worked on the Bardo case, I was struck by the fact that he did so many things that Hinckley had done before him. The two young men had early life experiences with some similarities, and that's no surprise. But the similarities of the choices they made later are nothing short of remarkable. For example, Hinckley knew that Mark Chapman had brought along a copy of Catcher in the Rye on his trip to murder John Lennon, so he brought one with him on his trip to shoot President Reagan. Bardo brought the same book along when he killed Rebecca Schaefer, later telling me he read it to find out how it made Chapman kill John Lennon. Look at this list of things that John Hinckley did before shooting President Reagan. Wrote letters to an actress, wrote songs, took a job in a restaurant, read Catcher in the Rye, crisscrossed the country, stalked public figures other than his final target, traveled to Hollywood, kept a diary, studied other assassins, visited the Dakota Building in New York City to see the place where John Lennon was murdered, considered an attention-getting suicide, sold off his possessions, wrote letters to be found after the attack, took a bus to the attack location, stalked his final target at more than one site before the attack, brought along Catcher in the Rye, didn't shoot at the first opportunity, left the scene after the first encounter, waited about a half hour, and then shot his target. Amazingly, Bardo also did every one of the things on this list. There are more than 30 striking similarities in the behavior of the two men. The predictability of pre-attack behaviors of assassins was confirmed by the work of Park Dietz, the psychiatrist and sociologist who first came to national attention as the lead prosecution expert in the Hinckley case. In 1982, when I was on the President's Advisory Board at the Department of Justice, I proposed a research project to study people who threaten and stalk public figures. Dietz was the expert we chose to run the project. From this and his other pioneering work, he assembled 10 behaviors common to modern assassins. Nearly every one of them: 1. Displayed some mental disorder. 2. Researched the target or victim. 3. Created a diary, journal, or record. 4. Obtained a weapon. 5. Communicated inappropriately with some public figure, though not necessarily the one attacked. 6. Displayed an exaggerated idea of self, grandiosity, narcissism. 7. Exhibited random travel. 8. Identified with a stalker or assassin. 9. Had the ability to circumvent ordinary security. 10. Made repeated approaches to some public figure. In protecting public figures, my office focuses on those who might try to kill clients, of course, but also those who might harm clients in other ways, such as through harassment or stalking. In evaluating cases, we consider 150 pre-incident indicators beyond those covered above. If we had to choose just one pin we'd want to be aware of above all others, it would be the one we call ability belief. This is a person's belief that he can accomplish a public figure attack. Without it, he cannot. In fact, to do anything, each of us must first believe on some level that we can do it. Accordingly, society's highest stakes question might be, do you believe you can succeed at shooting the president? Would-be assassins won't always answer this question truthfully, of course, nor will society always get the opportunity to ask it. But to the degree it can be measured, Ability belief is the pre-imminent, pre-incident indicator for assassination. If the truthful answer is no, what with all those Secret Service agents and special arrangements, I couldn't get within a mile of the guy. The person cannot shoot the president. Of course, this isn't a permanently reliable predictor, because ability belief can be influenced and changed. If, for example, I believe I could not possibly dive into the ocean from a 200-foot-high cliff, then I cannot. But a coach might influence my belief. Encouragement, teaching of skills that are part of the dive, taking of lesser dives, first from 20 feet, then 30, then 50, would all act to change my ability belief. No single influence is more powerful than social proof. Seeing someone else succeed at the thing you might have initially believed you could not do. Seeing a diver propel himself off an Acapulco cliff, sail down into the Pacific, and then emerge safely dramatically influences my belief that it can be done and that I could do it. Similarly, the enormous media attention showered on those who attack public figures bolsters ability belief in others. It says, you see, it can be done. Little wonder that in the period following a widely publicized attack, the risk of other attacks goes up dramatically. It is precisely because one encourages another that public figure attacks cluster. President Ford, 2 within 2 weeks. President Clinton, 2 within 6 weeks. Society appears to be promoting 2 very different messages. 1. It is nearly impossible to successfully attack a public figure, and if you do it and survive, you will be a pariah, despised, reviled, and forgotten. 2. It is very easy to successfully attack a public figure, and if you do it, you'll not only survive, but you'll be the center of international attention. Since we're discussing what amounts to a form of advertising, information following a public figure attack could be presented quite differently than it is now. Law enforcement personnel speaking with the press about a criminal who has been apprehended have tended to describe the arrest in terms of their victory over a dangerous, powerful, well-armed, and clever adversary. Investigators found 3 .45 caliber handguns and more than 200 rounds of ammunition in his hotel room. Since the perpetrator is a skilled marksman, it was touch and go when we stormed the building. This attaches to the criminal a kind of persona doubtless attractive to many who might consider undertaking a similar crime. I've recommended a different approach on my cases, one that casts the offender in a far less glamorous light. Imagine this press conference following the arrest of a person who is planning an assassination. Would you describe the man as a loner? Federal agent. More of a loser, actually. Did he put up any resistance when taken into custody? No, we found him hiding in the bathroom in the clothes hamper. Could he have succeeded in the assassination? I doubt it very much. He's never succeeded at anything else. Ideally, the agent would always switch the focus to the people and special methods that act in opposition to assassins, keeping the focus off the criminal. Federal agent. I want to commend the 8-man team of special agents whose investigative work and application of new technologies made the apprehension possible so rapidly. I propose that we don't show the bullets on the bureau in the seedy hotel room. Show instead the dirty underwear and socks on the bathroom floor. I propose that we don't arrange photo opportunities that show the offender being escorted by 10 federal agents from a helicopter to a motorcade of waiting cars. Show him instead in a mangy T-shirt, handcuffed to a pipe in some gloomy corridor, watched by one guard, and a woman at that. Not many identity-seeking would-be assassins would see those images and say, "Yeah, that's the life for me." Conversely, guarded by federal agents, just like the president, whisked into waiting helicopters, just like the president, his childhood home shown on TV, just like the president, the type of gun he owned fired on the news by munitions experts extolling its killing power, the plans he made described as meticulous. These presentations promote the glorious aspects of assassination and other media crimes. Getting caught for some awful violence should be the start of oblivion, not the biggest day of one's life. But it was the biggest day in the life of accused Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh, who was paraded in front of the waiting press, surrounded by FBI agents, rushed to a motorcade, and then whisked away in a two-helicopter armada. We saw this even more with accused Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, whose close-up appeared on the covers of Time, U.S. News and World Report, and Newsweek twice. The cover text of all three described Kaczynski as a genius. Reporters usually refer to assassins with triple names, like Mark David Chapman, Lee Harvey Oswald, Arthur Richard Jackson. One might come to believe that assassins actually used these pretentious triple names in their pre-attack lives. They didn't. They were Mark, Lee, and Arthur. I propose promoting the least glamorous incarnation of their names. Call a criminal Ted Smith instead of Theodore Bryant Smith. Better still, find some nickname used in his pre-attack life. Federal agent. His name is Theodore Smith, but he was known as Chubby Ted. Our culture presents many role models, but few get as much hoopla and glory as the assassin. Those who have succeeded, and even some of those who failed, are among the most famous people in American lore. John Wilkes Booth survives history with more fame than all but a few other Americans of his time. The tragically symbiotic relationship between assassins and television news is understandable. Assassins give great video, very visual, very dramatic. Assassins will not sue you, no matter what you say about them, and they provide the story feature most desired by news producers, extendability. There will be more information, more interviews with neighbors and experts, more pictures from the high school yearbook. There will be a trial with the flavor of a horse race between lawyers, made famous just for the occasion, and there will be the drama of waiting for the verdict. Best of all, there will be that video of the attack, again and again. The problem, however, is that that video may be a commercial for assassination, as surely as Procter and Gamble ever pushed toothpaste, the approach of television news pushes public figure attack. Way back in 1911, criminologist Arthur MacDonald wrote, "The most dangerous criminals are the assassins of rulers." He suggested that newspapers, magazines, and authors of books cease to publish the names of criminals. If this not be done voluntarily, let it be made a misdemeanor to do so. This would lessen the hope for glory, renown, or notoriety, which is a great incentive to such crimes. MacDonald would be disappointed to see that media age assassins end up with virtual network shows, but he would not be surprised. After all, the early morning mist of mass media hype was already thick even in his day. In 1912, a man named John Schrank attempted to kill Theodore Roosevelt. While he was in jail, his bail was abruptly raised because motion picture men had planned to pay it and secure his release long enough to restage the assassination attempt for newsreels. Objecting to the movie, the prosecutor told the court he was concerned about the demoralizing effect such a picture film would have. It would tend to make a hero out of this man, and I don't propose that the young shall be allowed to worship him as a hero. Probably not realizing they were pioneering a new genre, the frustrated motion picture men picked out a building that resembled the jail and filmed an actor who looked like Schrank emerging between two bogus deputy sheriffs. No discussion of assassination would be complete without exploring the precautions that can be taken to prevent these attacks. First, of course, just as with any danger, one must learn that a hazard exists. In the Bardo case, for example, there were many warnings. Over a 2-year period, he had sent Rebecca Schaefer a stream of inappropriate letters through her agents in New York and Los Angeles. When Bardo showed up at the studio where her show was taped, it was a studio security guard who told him which stage she was on. Bardo himself said, It was way too easy.
On one of his visits to the studio, he explained to the chief of security that he was in love with Rebecca Schaefer and had traveled from Arizona to see her. After telling Bardo the actress didn't want to see him, the security chief, personally, drove him back to the motel where he was staying. Unfortunately, even having seen, though perhaps not recognized, several obvious warning signs, the security chief didn't see to it that Rebecca Schaefer was informed about the lovesick man who had been pursuing her for 2 years and had just traveled hundreds of miles by bus to meet her. After the shooting, the security chief explained his meeting with Bardo to reporters.
I thought he was just lovesick. We get 100 in a year. People trying to get in, fans writing letters.
To the security chief, it was a matter of handling some fan according to what he called standard procedure. But to Bardo, it was a powerful and emotional event.
Bardo, I had problems with the security at the studio and the feeling I had toward them. I just put it on Ms. Schaefer.
What was that feeling?
It was anger, extreme anger, because they said, no, you can't come in. Get out of here. Get away from this place. They said, she's not interested. She doesn't want to be bothered. And I just felt that she was the one that I would discuss that with personally in an encounter.
But she didn't say that, did she?
No. But I felt, I perceived that that's what she was like.
The security chief's account continues. Bardo was terribly insistent on being let in. Rebecca Schaefer was every other word. I gotta see her. I love her. Something was definitely wrong mentally. There was something haywire going on, but I didn't perceive it as potentially violent.
In an unanswered refrain often heard after preventable tragedies, the security chief added,
"What more could I have done?"
About 2 weeks after Rebecca Schaefer was killed, there was another much-publicized stalking incident that answers the question. It involved a would-be assailant I'll call Stephen Janoff. He had once pursued a client of mine, and though our evaluation determined he did not likely pose a hazard to our client, we were concerned that he might be dangerous to a co-star on our client's television show. We met with that actress and told her about the case. Police and studio security warned the pursuer off, assuming that would resolve the matter. It didn't, of course. About a year later, the actress was in rehearsing for a play. One day, she saw a man outside the theater who caught her attention, and she couldn't shake the feeling that he might be the person we had warned her about, so she called us. After some inquiry, we confirmed to her that Stephen Janoff was indeed the man she had seen, and that he was there in pursuit of her. She and her representatives asked for and then exactly followed our recommendations. She stopped using the front entrance to the theater for her rehearsal visits. The box office was provided with Janoff's photo and some guidance on what to do if he showed up. She agreed to have a security person with her, and she applied several other strategies we designed to limit the likelihood of an unwanted encounter. For 5 days, Janoff stalked the actress. But because of her precautions, he was unable to encounter her. Janoff had purchased a ticket for the opening night of her play, though he wasn't patient enough to wait till then. One afternoon, he walked right up to the box office, where an employee recognized him and sent out a call to police. Janoff produced a handgun and demanded to see the actress. The employee, hoping the gun was not loaded, ran off. Janoff turned the gun on himself, announcing that he would pull the trigger unless the actress was brought to him. After a 4-hour standoff with police, he was taken into custody. Not only did it turn out that the gun was loaded, but Janoff had a collection of other firearms back at his hotel room. The Janoff case shows the enormous improvements the entertainment industry has made to address the safety of media figures. Several theatrical agencies, movie studios, and management firms now routinely have inappropriate communications and visits professionally evaluated. Unlike in the Bardo case, media figures are now more likely to be informed of inappropriate pursuit. These and other improvements have brought clear results. Successful attacks against media figures have been sharply reduced in recent years. I wish I could say the same for professional sports, which brings to mind the murder attempt on the young tennis star Monica Seles. Though it certainly won't be the last attack on a sports figure, with a little effort, it could be the last one facilitated by negligence. Before I give you some little-known details about the Seles case, I want to discuss something about the hazards public figures face that is relevant to your safety. It is the myth that violence cannot be prevented. John Kennedy once made the point that assassins could not be stopped because all anyone has to do is be willing to trade his life for the president's. Kennedy's oft-quoted opinion is glib, but entirely wrong. In fact, assassination not only can be prevented, it is prevented far more often than it succeeds. Though assassins have a few advantages over their victims, there are many more factors working against them. Literally, thousands of opportunities exist for them to fail, and only one slender opportunity exists for them to succeed. It's not the type of crime a person can practice, both literally and figuratively. An assassin has one shot at success. Like John Kennedy, people who apply a fatalistic attitude to their own safety, e.g., burglary cannot be prevented, someone can always find a way in, often do so as an excuse not to take reasonable precautions. Yes, a committed criminal might well be difficult to stop, but the absence of precautions makes you vulnerable to the uncommitted criminal. In the Seles case, everybody knew that it made sense for her to have security at her public appearances in Europe. Because she was deeply enmeshed in the continent's greatest conflict, the Serbs versus the Croats, her public appearances frequently brought political demonstrations. She routinely had bodyguards at her tournaments, as she did at the 1993 Citizen Tournament in Germany. Nevertheless, soon after arriving on the court, one of history's most brilliant athletes lay on her back, bleeding from a serious injury. Though ostensibly protected by two bodyguards, she had fallen victim to a knife attack, the most preventable of all assassination methods. Why did the bodyguards fail and assailant Günter Parke succeed? One of the two bodyguards, Manfred, answers my question in his statement to the police, but he begins with the wrong words. I am a telecommunications worker. I have a side job for the private guard firm at the tennis grounds. Presumably, a star tennis player could fairly have the expectation that the bodyguards assigned to her would in fact be bodyguards, professionals with some relevant training and experience. She might fairly expect that they would have at least discussed the possibility of a safety hazard, maybe even discussed what they would do should one present itself. But none of that happened, and the promoters did not tell her that the people they had assigned to guard her life were unqualified part-timers. She had to learn that when Günter Parke plunged the knife into her back and then raised his arm to do it again. The second bodyguard's name is Henry, and his statement too begins with the wrong words. My main job is as a loader at Hamburg Harbor. I have a side job where I am in charge of security at the tennis grounds. At this tournament, my job was specifically to accompany and look after Monica Seles. Amazingly, both men reported that they took special notice of assailant Günter Parke prior to the stabbing. Henry pegged the attacker quite accurately. Call it a sixth sense or whatever, I cannot explain it, but I noticed the man. Something told me that something was not quite right with this man. He was swaying instead of walking. I cannot explain it in more detail. I just had an uneasy feeling when I saw the man. As I said, I cannot explain it in more detail. Though he clearly had an intuition about the assailant, his main message appears to be that he cannot explain it. Rather than tell anyone about his concerns, Henry decided instead to put down a coffee cup, which he was holding in his hand even though he was on a protective detail for the most controversial figure in world tennis, and stroll over to do I don't know what, and he didn't know what. Of course, he had taken only a few steps by the time the attack had started
and finished. It's perhaps not fair to criticize Henry and Manfred, for they know not what they do. That, however, is exactly my point. While Celis was recovering from the knife wound, tennis promoters set out to promote the idea that such attacks cannot be prevented. Here is promoter Jerry Diamond telling interviewers on CNN that screening for weapons with metal detectors would never work in tennis. When you're working in an enclosed facility where you've got walls and a ceiling and a roof, yeah, all those things are possible. But a metal detector is not going to deter anyone who is determined to go in that direction. His statement that weapon screening can't work for tennis because some facilities lack walls and ceilings makes no sense. When I heard it, I was offended that someone would throw around life-and-death opinions with such misplaced confidence. Though he later called weapon screening ludicrous, Mr. Diamond has, throughout his career, managed to screen every single spectator for something far smaller than a weapon, a tiny piece of paper. The ticket he sold them. He doesn't know, I imagine, that most television shows now have metal detector screening for audiences. Why? Because if they didn't, some armed person with the intent of harming a TV star could get a ticket and get within immediate reach of his target, just like Robert Bardo did when he visited Rebecca Schaefer's TV show carrying a concealed knife, and just like Parker did at the Citizen Tournament. When you screen audience members, you don't have to worry about what is in people's heads because you know what is in their purses and pockets. Weapon screening is good enough for courthouses, airlines, TV shows, city halls, concerts, high schools, even the Super Bowl, no ceiling, but somehow a businessman tells us it can't work for tennis. Of course, it's convenient to see it Mr. Diamond's way, because if attacks are unpreventable, then he and other promoters have no duty to try to prevent them. Questioned by reporters about security weaknesses in professional tennis, another spokesperson explained that since tournaments occur all over the world, security precautions cannot be standardized. Really? Everywhere in the world, they require that each tennis ball must bounce 135 to 147 centimeters when dropped from 2.5 meters. Everywhere in the world, the courts are required to be exactly 23.8 meters long and 8.2 meters wide, with service courts that extend exactly 6.4 meters from the net to the service line. This sounds like standardization to me. And yet they asked, how could you possibly have a standard credential and access control system in all those countries? Well, you just have to go to the trouble of implementing one. After the Celis attack, the Women's Tennis Council publicized that they'd enhanced security. Yet they didn't require promoters to take two obvious steps, the use of metal detectors for screening spectators and the installation of clear plastic audience barricades, like those at hockey games. Weak security improvements, including those you might make in your own life, are sometimes worse than doing nothing because they give false peace of mind and convince people that safety is being addressed when it is not. Poorly designed security fools everyone, except the attacker. When people hear about some public figure stalker, they may think the case can be added to a list that consists of Chapman and Hinckley and those few others they recall. In fact, each is added to a far longer list. My office has managed more than 20,000 cases, and only a quarter of 1% have ever become public. Several individual clients of mine have received as many as 10,000 letters a week from members of the general public, some of which meet the criteria for review by our threat management staff. Death threats, stalking, bizarre demands, and persistent pursuit are all part of public life in America. Our work carries us to an underside of this culture that most people would not believe exists, but it does exist. Just out of view, just below the surface. Here is a brief sampling of the kinds of cases we encountered in 1 2-year period. A woman wrote more than 6,000 death threats to a client because he was marrying the wrong person. A man sent a client of ours a dead coyote, which the sender had killed because it was beautiful, like you. A man sent several letters each day to the actress with whom he hoped to have a romantic relationship. 6 times a week, he walked miles to his local post office to see if a reply had arrived. Over 8 years, he had sent the actress more than 12,000 letters, one of which included a photo of him with the inscription, "Can you see the gun in this picture?" We were waiting for him when he showed up at her home. A man who was obsessed with becoming famous shaved off one eyebrow, half his head, and half his beard, then traveled cross-country in pursuit of a famous actor. He arrived in the actor's hometown and went directly to a sporting goods store, where he priced a rifle and scope. He was arrested the night before our client made a major public appearance. When I interviewed the stalker, he told me that, "Whoever kills Caesar becomes a great man." A man sent a famous singer a picture of a heart pierced by a knife. 6 months later, he was at her gate to serenade her to kingdom come. And then there are those who committed terrible crimes against others, influenced by delusions involving some distant public figure. A man attacked a teenage girl with a knife because he thought she was the famous model he was obsessed with. A teenage girl killed her parents and said she was ordered to do it by a movie star. In one case that became very public, a man named Ralph Now had sinister delusions involving 4 different famous women, all clients of our office. He focused primarily on one whom he believed was an evil impostor. He killed a dog and sent the teeth to one of our clients. Later, he traveled more than 30,000 miles to destinations around the world in search of her. He knew where the imposter lived, but didn't go there. Once he attended a concert given by the imposter, unaware that all the seats around him were occupied by threat management agents. We investigated ways to get him incarcerated or hospitalized, but he went to work reliably and never broke the law. He worked at a veterinary clinic, so even the killing of the dog could not be proven to be criminal. We monitored him closely every day for 3 years, after which he returned to his family home. I notified his father that references in some of his 600 letters convinced us he would likely be dangerous to someone in his family. Within a few months, he had killed his 8-year-old half-brother with an axe. The boy was preventing him from watching something very important on television. A signal about my client that he felt was being sent to him, even though he confessed to the killing, Now was acquitted on a technicality. Every few months, he's able to petition the court to release him from a mental hospital, and every few months, we stand ready to testify against him. Given the number of cases evaluated by our threat management office, a virtual assembly line of madness and danger, I have had to be mindful of the need to keep a human connection between protector and pursuer, for only then are predictions likely to be accurate. Members of my staff who work on assessments put together a profile on each case. At some point, we begin to refer to individuals under assessment as profiles. This became part of a growing terminology unique to our work, some of which I've shared with you in this book. For example, those people who believe they are the Messiah, Captain Kirk, or Marilyn Monroe are described as Dell ID cases for delusions of identity. Those who believe they are married to one of our clients are called Spouse Dell for spousal delusion. Those who feel they are acting under the direction of God or voices or devices installed in their brains are known as Outcon cases, short for outside control. I used to be concerned that this vernacular would dehumanize and depersonalize our assessments, but as we met more and more pursuers, came to know their lives more closely and understand their torment and the tragedy for their families, this concern evaporated. One can't help being profoundly affected by close involvement with people whose lives are a twisted chain of police encounters, hospitalization, relentless pursuit by imagined enemies, perceived betrayal by their loved ones, restlessness that moves them to new places,
only to be restless there and move again, and above all, loneliness. No, there's no chance that my office will get too far from the human side of our assessment work. We can't forget the young man who broke out of a mental hospital, mailed a final letter to a distant public figure he loved, and then committed suicide. We can't forget those who killed others and somehow involved a media figure in their crime. Above all, we cannot and will not forget those who might try to harm our clients. In their search for attention and identity, most assassins go, as Park Dietz has put it, to the people who have the most identity to spare, famous people. Assassins know that when someone kills or attempts to kill a famous person in America, it is the grandest of all media events. A television reporter will stand with his camera crew just a few feet from another reporter standing with her camera crew, and invariably they will each call the crime a senseless act. But assassination is anything but senseless to the perpetrator, and those reporters are part of the sense it makes. The literally millions of dollars spent videotaping every single walk a president takes to and from a car or helicopter makes sense, too. Some call it the assassination watch, and electronic news organizations have obviously concluded that the cost of all those crews and all those satellite dish vans, all that equipment, and all that wasted videotape is worth the images they'll get if somebody starts firing a gun. Thus, television and the assassin have invested in the same crime, and every few years they together collect the profit from it. Remember Arthur Bremer, who set out to assassinate President Nixon but later settled on presidential candidate George Wallace? He weighed his act in terms that would make Nielsen proud. In his journal, which he always intended to publish after he became famous, Bremer worried about his ratings. "If something big in NAM flares up, my attack won't get more than 3 minutes on network TV news." These senseless acts make perfect sense. Chapter 14. Extreme Hazards. In ourselves our safety must be sought. By our own right hand it must be wrought. William Wordsworth. All of us will encounter people in our lives who alarm us, or might pose some hazard. But as you've seen, a prominent public figure can have literally hundreds of people seeking unwanted encounters. I'm not talking about fans. I'm talking about people who feel they are under orders from God to harm a famous person, or who believe they are destined to marry a particular star, or who believe some media figure is being held hostage, and on and on. These cases have lessons any of us can benefit from. I want to present one that will demonstrate that even the most extreme safety hazards are manageable. This book has explored obsessions, death threats, stalking, mental illness, child abuse, multiple shootings, and children who kill their parents. Amazingly, there is one case that brings all these elements together, a virtual hall of fame of American violence. At about 4 p.m. on July 20th, 1983, I was at a hotel in Los Angeles to meet with a client who was finishing a public appearance event. As I crossed the lobby, I was waved over by one of several people assigned to my client from my company's Protective Security Division, PSD. He told me about an important radio call from our office that he suggested I take in one of our cars. As always, I found the cars lined up, drivers at the ready, fully prepared for an unscheduled departure, our euphemism for an emergency. The report I received was an alarming one. It would clear my schedule for that day and for the 30 days that followed. Police in Jennings Parish, Louisiana, have discovered the bodies of 5 people brutally murdered. The lead suspect is Michael Perry. It was not the first time I'd heard that name. Michael Perry was among thousands of mentally ill pursuers my office had under assessment, but one of the very few we placed in the highest hazard category. The radio call was personal to me because the public figure Perry was obsessed with was not only a longtime client, she was also a dear friend. The client Perry was obsessed with is an internationally known recording artist and film actress. She already had a team of PSD agents who'd been assigned to her home for about a year. The precaution of full-time bodyguards had been undertaken in part because we predicted that Perry might show up, and in part because of another murderous stalker. Ralph Now. The radio crackled with bulletins between my office and the security personnel at my client's house in Malibu. Someone from our threat management division was already speaking with local police, and a meeting was scheduled for me at the FBI field office. Alarming reports are not uncommon for major media figures, but usually the more you learn about a situation, the less serious it turns out to be. The opposite happened in the Michael Perry case. He was an accomplished survivalist who had been in Los Angeles several times in pursuit of her. Perry's parents were among the homicide victims, and a high-powered rifle and at least two handguns were missing from their home. Perry had had more than enough time to reach Los Angeles. He had recently told a psychiatrist that my client was evil and should be killed. Before making that call, however, I was informed of one more detail that changed everything. Based on what I learned about a few words Perry had written on a sheet of paper found at the murder scene, I did something I'd never done before and haven't done since, even though clients have faced very serious hazards. I called my client and asked her to pack for a few days because I'd be there within a half hour to pick her up and take her to a hotel. Given what I now knew, I didn't feel we could adequately protect her at her home, even with a team of bodyguards. By the time I got to my client's neighborhood, the street had been closed by police and a sheriff's helicopter was buzzing loudly overhead. Within minutes, I was answering my client's anxious questions as we drove away from her home, followed closely by a PSD backup car. We'd be met at the hotel by two more PSD people. We would enter through a loading dock and be taken upstairs via a service elevator. A room near my client's suite was being modified to serve as a security command center. Two people from my office had already left Los Angeles bound for Louisiana. By the time they got to the murder scene the next morning, the bodies had been removed, but photos revealed a gruesome aspect of the homicides. Perry had shot out his parents' eyes with a shotgun. He had also killed an infant nephew in the same house and then broken into another house and killed two more people. In the living room of his parents' house, we saw that he'd fired several shotgun blasts into a wall heater. The damaged heater was a mystery we'd solve the next day, along with why he had shot out the eyes of his victims. But at that point, we were looking past these details in search of a single sheet of paper. Near where the bodies were found was a small pad printed up as a promotion for a local dry cleaner. On the top page was a collection of names, some crossed out, then rewritten, some intersected by lines that connected them to other names, some circled, some underlined, some in a column, others separated into groups of three or four. The names and lines were Perry's efforts to narrow down to 10 the number of people he intended to kill. Some were in Louisiana, one in Texas, one in Washington, D.C., and one in Malibu, the one that concerned me most. Little could any of these people have known that they were part of a bizarre contest between the enemies of Michael Perry. Little could they have known that in a small, dingy house in Louisiana, a man sitting with the bodies of three relatives he'd just shot was calmly and studiously weighing whether they would live or die. Perry wrote the word sky near the names of those he'd killed already, and he crossed out some others that didn't make his top 10. When he was done, my client's name remained. Now I had to find Michael Perry. His list not only brought us to the humid bayou, but started my excavation of Perry's history.
In the weeks that followed, I would come to know his family and the people of Jennings Parish very well. Come to know his schizophrenic sister, the doctors he'd told about his plan to kill people in groups of 10. The coroner, who would later FedEx us plaster cast of Perry's shoe prints from the murder scene. The neighbor boy, who told us how Perry had decapitated his dog. The librarian, who had lent Perry the books on survivalism that made him so hard to catch. I would soon know Michael Perry better than anyone else had ever wanted to know him. While people from my office began their second day in Louisiana, others quickly hustled my client from the hotel to a safe house we rented out of state. Others pursued leads in California, Nevada, Texas, Washington, D.C., New York, and even Africa. In Louisiana, Jennings Parish's small sheriff's department placed all three of its investigators on the Michael Perry case. My office added another 14 people to the search. Grace and Chester Perry had long ago predicted that their son would someday kill them. Whenever he was in town, his mother locked herself in the house, and he was rarely allowed in unless his father was home. They kept family guns hidden, paid Perry money to leave whenever he visited, and slept easier when he was off on one of his trips to California looking for my client. It's unclear exactly when he got angry enough to orphan himself, but it may have been at 7 years old, when, according to him, his mother pushed him against the wall heater in their home. Certainly the disfiguring and, to him, shameful burns on his legs daily reminded him of that incident. The shotgun blasts at the heater were a too-little-too-late revenge that had waited more than 20 years. As Michael Perry grew up, stories about him were always making the rounds, and neighbors had given up trying to figure out why he did the bizarre things he did. For example, he liked to be called by the nickname Crab, but then hired a lawyer to legally change his name to I. Everybody thought it was just another of his senseless ideas, but it did make sense. Michael Perry hadn't been the only 6-year-old whose father came home from work and questioned him about his various transgressions of the day, such as riding his bike in the street. He was, however, probably the only one whose father knew the details of each and every misdeed. Perry's father had been so uncannily accurate because a neighbor had agreed to watch the boy from her porch and then report his activities to Chester. His father told Michael, "When I go to work, I leave my eyes at home." Perry spent 28 years trying to hide from the scrutiny of those eyes. He even tried to symbolically become an eye. Then on July 19, 1983, he closed his